While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Pardon me. On the radio broadcast weekdays from 1300 hours to 1430, and this program focuses on unpacking the policies, the economic indicators, and institutional decisions shaping Namibia's development trajectory. Because headlines tell us what happened, but analysis help us understand why it matters. Now, at a time when economic choices carry heightened consequences, and communities across the country are calling for tangible improvements in service delivery, we deliberately pause to examine how legislation translates into implementation, how national budgets convert into real services, and how leadership decisions impact everyday life, from Windhoek to the coast, the north and the south. I like traditional news bulletins on the radar create space for structured, balanced, and solutions-oriented discussions. We bring together subject matters, experts, policymakers, analysts, and members of the public to ensure that debate remains grounded in verifiable facts and focus on constructive outcomes. As Namibia enters into another day of policy deliberation and economic reflection, we remain committed to clarity over noise, accountability over rhetoric, and substance over speculation. So stay with us as informed debate meets a national purpose right here on the Radar. Let's get right into these discussions. Namibia is poised to exit the Financial Action Task Force, or FATF, green list after successfully addressing all 13 strategic deficiencies identified in its anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing framework. The country was grey listed by the Financial Action Task Force in February 2024 following concerns over weaknesses in its AML-CFT regime. Now, at the time, Namibia made a firm political commitment to remedy the shortcomings within a set action plan. At its plenary meeting held on the 9th to the 13th of February 2026 in Mexico, the FATF made an initial determination that Namibia has substantial completed its action plan. The global watchdog confirmed that the country now warrants an on-site assessment to verify the implementation and sustainability of the reforms. Now, according to the Financial Intelligence Center, Namibia strengthened its risk-based supervision by increasing human and technical capacity, conducting both off-site and on-site inspections, and applying effective proportionally and dissuasive sanctions for non-compliance. Now, authorities also enhance preventative measures to ensure financial institutions and designated non-financial business implemented, enhance due diligence, and comply with targeted financial sanctions related to terrorism and proliferation financing. The country further improved compliance with beneficial ownership requirements, increased remedial actions for breaches, and boosted the operational and strategic capacity of the Financial Intelligence Unit. Cooperation between the FIU, that is the Financial Institute, Financial Intelligence Unit, and the law enforcement agencies has been strengthened to improve the integration of financial intelligence into investigations. Law enforcement agencies have also demonstrated increased capability to investigate and prosecute money laundering and terrorism financing cases. In addition, the amended National Counterterrorism Strategy has been approved, and notably, Namibia completed all required reforms ahead of May 2026 deadline. The next step in the process will be an on-site assessment by the Africa Joint Group, which will verify whether the reforms reported in progress updates have been fully implemented. The assessment is scheduled for April 2026, with the outcome expected to be represented at the next FATF preliminary in June 2026. The Financial Intelligence Center says it is coordinating with key national stakeholders to prepare for the review, and it has also acknowledged the support of Cabinet and various institutions, describing the political backing as critical to strengthening Namibia's domestic AML and CTF framework and contributing to global efforts to combat financial crime, corruption, and illicit financial flows. A successful on-site assessment would clear the way for Namibia's formal removal from the AFTF grey list later this year. For now, let's now pause right here and get in touch with Mr. Brian Asab of the Financial Intelligence Center.
Lipura nengelo wapubwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo deto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe faa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge fatafano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of
its. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now joining us telephonically is Mr. Brian Asab, the Financial Intelligence Center's Director. A very good afternoon to you, sir, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon to you and to all the listeners.
Mr. Brian, of course, we're talking about Namibia's removal from the grey listing by the FAFT. Now, I think one of the very first questions I would want to ask is, what is the economic impact of grey listing for any country?
Thank you so much for the question. I think this is a very topical question, and it is probably a question that confronts everyone, and rightfully it should, because the strengthening of our anti-money laundering framework is a responsibility of each and every Namibian citizen.
Mm.
So coming back to your question, is the economic impact on grey listing of a country can be devastating at some point in time.
Mm.
This is obviously a macroeconomic policy matter, and I think what Namibia has been able to do successfully was to contain it at that level, at a macroeconomic level, and not allow it to trickle down into a microeconomic environment where the ordinary citizen is directly affected. So we were successful in that regard. But the economic impact, if Namibia was not a cooperating country with the global community under the FATF watchdog auspices, we probably would have had a much more severe economic impact. Not that we had any, but the impact could have been much more severe, because the compliance cost that would have been imposed on international transactions, with Namibia being a major importing country, would have been so much higher. So what the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund is estimating the economic impact for grey listing is around between 5 to 7% of GDP of a country.
Sure.
Fortunately, in Namibia, we have not seen that impact over the 2 years that Namibia has been graylisted now.
That's good news also that we didn't actually get to feel that. And tell us, Mr. Brian, how did the Financial Intelligence Center and your team, of course, how did you actually do it? We know we are yet to be removed, but the fact that we have met the requirements that were left for us to do, how did you actually achieve it?
I think credit should be extended to each and every Namibian. I think we have all, from both the public sector and the private sector, we have all muscled together and pushed this flywheel in one direction. So what we have done as a national coordinating institution, as soon as we were graylisted, we obviously looked at what is the action plan, what does it contain, what is the critical flight path that we need to undertake to have these reforms, you know, brought about in a sustainable manner. And I think that's the important key word here, and the imperative is that this is not exiting the grey listing. It for us was always an inescapable eventuality, but there's more to it. For Namibia and the demonstration from the highest in our country, from, you know, the late president, Dr. Kaingop, and his successor, Dr. Ndaitwa, was that there was absolute political commitment at all levels. And then we were able to muster together a team of technical experts and policy experts from across various institutions, to include the Anti-Corruption Commission, the Namibian Police, the Business and Intellectual Property Authority, NAMFISA, the Office of the Prosecutor General, the Office of the Master of the High Court, the Bank of Namibia, the FIC, the Bankers Association. So it was a multi-sectoral approach when we looked at what is it that Namibia has to do within this two years that was set as a deadline. So our deadline is expiring in May 2026 this year. But because of the coordination and really rallying behind the scores of Namibia being exited from the FATF grey list, has caused us to, you know, complete the action plan in much faster time. So we got the news last week.
Mm-hmm.
One of my colleagues attended the FATF plenary, and the FATF plenary then accepted that Namibia has largely addressed all the strategic deficiencies, which range from various aspects, amongst others. You know, we had to intensify our supervision as the FIC over the financial sector, the banks and other non-bank financial institutions like insurance companies. So we did that in tandem with NAMPISA and the Bank of Namibia. And we also had to make sure that Business and Intellectual Property Authority, BIPA, was filing beneficial ownership information. And that information is available to competent authorities like the Namibian Police in the event they want to conduct parallel financial investigations. So it was really a multi-sectoral approach. And then one key issue was that some of these institutions like the ACC, the FIC, the Namibian Police, the Office of the Prosecutor General must have been adequately resourced through human resources, mm-hmm. and also capacitating those human resources. So it was not just an issue of resourcing, but also making sure that those institutions, the investigators, understand how to investigate financial crimes, how to conduct parallel financial investigations, and not merely focus on the underlying offense. For example, if it was corruption, how do you then do a parallel financial investigation and seek for assets that was acquired through the corrupt means and go after that asset, you know, deprive the wrongdoers of benefiting from those assets. So those were some of the key issues. And then obviously our ability to identify, investigate and disrupt terrorism financing and terrorism activities.
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, those were the high level issues that we had to deal with.
So in other words, you're saying Namibian institutions, especially the ones that also had the, their part to play, came together and as a team, and this was actually combated as a team as opposed to just one institution dealing with it.
That's right. So it was really a collective effort amongst all these institutions that I've just mentioned.
Yeah.
And I think, again, I would always underscore the fact that we had the highest level of political commitment. You will note that even in NDP-6, they quite a clear target on reducing illicit financial flows, which is currently estimated at about 9% of our GDP. So by 2030, we plan to have that illicit financial flow target reduced to at least a minimum of 5%, which is quite significant. And I think what we have done as a country now is obviously a building block and a step in the right direction.
Interesting. Now, but Mr. Brian, during the grey listing period, did you, as the director, feel the burden as the head of financial intelligence?
As leaders, we should never call it a burden. We should call it our responsibility to ensure that we put our country always first. We should always put our country on the map. And we should, as many have done before us and many that will come after us, we should always strive to cause Namibia to be a better country for our generation, for the generations that will come, and make those that have gone before us and they sacrificed their lives, make them proud, even, you know, in their post-mortem status.
Mm-hmm. What lessons did you learn from all this?
The lesson that I have learned at an individual level is to, amidst all the noise, maintain focus, understand what is it that we have to achieve, what are the timelines that we have to achieve, and what is the quality at what we have to achieve certain matters. So, and again, coordination and the collective responsibility of all Namibians was key for us. This was not an FIC issue. This was a collective responsibility, and everybody, all the institutions, the leaders of those institutions under the Anti-Money Laundering Council came together. We realized the importance, especially now that Namibia is on the verge of this nascent industry called the oil industry. We couldn't allow our country to be blemished and continue our country to be looked at by foreigners as, you know, as for example, as a money laundering hub. So we came together, and the lesson that I've learned is that Namibians are reliable, Namibians are trustworthy, and if they are called upon to defend their country in whatever form or manner, they do rise to the occasion.
Indeed. As you speak about oil, I tend to wonder, did we perhaps have any investors who did not want to come and invest in Namibia because of the grey listing?
Not that we are aware of. In fact, the contrary is probably true. When in our engagement with the NIPDB, because this was something that we always had somewhat of a peripheral outlook on, to determine, you know, the impact of grey listing. In fact, if you look at the statistics, and I unfortunately don't have it with me at this point, but if you look at the statistics in terms of investment that the NIPDB reported, is that there was actually a surge in investment within Namibia during this 2-year period. And I think the reason for that was the fact that Namibia is committed to make sure that our financial system is void of money laundering, terrorism financing, and that investors drew comfort to the fact that there was political commitment and institutional commitment, and the capacity was developed both in private and public sector to ensure that any investment that would flow into our country is safe, it's secure, and investors would be able to return their investment at the time when they would want to do that. So we have not seen any disinvestment. We have not seen any reluctance from investors. And what I can also share with the listeners is that what we have seen is that some of the investors would inquire whether it would be via the Ministry of Finance or the Ministry of International Relations and Trade in relation to what is the status of Namibia remediating the strategic deficiencies. And the progress that we have shown quarter on quarter has given that comfort to investors that the political commitment and the institutional capacity is not merely lip service, but it is actually providing or giving some tangible results, and that there is absolute commitment into the future to strengthen our anti-money laundering framework in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Brian, we do know of a good saying that says all things work together for good. Now, in terms of Namibia being grey-listed, of course, you did speak about how institutions had to level up on human capacity and, of course, on technical capacity. Would you say this listing, this grey-listing, did actually work also for our good, because then we needed to buckle up and ensure that institutions work together? What do you say?
Absolutely. As the saying goes, you should never let an opportunity go to waste. So, and that was really our focus. When we were grey-listed, while it seemed to be all gloomy and doom, we said that what is it that we can learn and take out of this eventuality and this experience? And for us, it was really to focus on strengthening our criminal justice system, and making sure that, you know, putting building blocks in place, because this is not a once-off event. Now that we know how to deal with certain high-profile crimes from a systematic point of view, we can just build on it and strengthen our end-to-end processes over the criminal justice system, from the Namibian police up to the prosecution, because the judiciary, that's an independent function, and we do not want to move into that sphere. But nonetheless, even in that respect, there were some endeavors under the Chief Justice's office to capacitate judges and understand this complex technical matter of money laundering and the associated crimes.
Okay. Mr. Brian Issa, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reading News Analysis. And a big congratulations also to meeting those requirements that were put out by FATF for Namibia.
Thank you so much. I would call upon each and every Namibian, now that we are going to be assessed on-site, the FATF Joint Group Reviewers will be in country during April, that we maintain this momentum and intensify it and make it happen into the future for generations to come. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Okay, sir.
Okay. Awesome.
Thank you. And of course, that was Mr. Brian Aseb, director of the Financial Intelligence Center. And for now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with more. Stay tuned right here on the Reader News Analysis.
Lipura nengeno wapubwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe udite opoye ekukurile oshafafana no.
Fall in love with the best prices at WB. Get 500 gram Bokomo cornflakes for $31.99, 2 kg nice rice for only $34.99, 1.5 kg real good mixed chicken portions for $79.99, and 10 kg Bokomo fat cook flour for just $137.99. See more February specials at vurmanbrock.com. We care.
Kapeno nwe udite opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito danjuka oku kwetera oipindi konu konda doinawa. Nuneudo, otu kwetera o special, geta shake ngejepa omarudi dayo loka, opone ushendi fenawa, nokumona oijamo irinawa, ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM, onora itatu imwe bali heali, nola natu heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, oma felane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now, on this also on grade listing of Namibia by the Financial Action Task Force, or also known as the FATF, I've reached out to Dr. Omuka Koyamatundu, who is an economist. Let's take a listen to that conversation. A very good afternoon to you, Dr. Omuka Koyamatundu, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis yet again.
Yes, good morning, Happy, and good morning to your listeners.
Mm. Now, Dr. Omu, Namibia is poised to exit the Financial Action Task Force that is grade listing after successfully addressing all 13 strategic deficiencies identified in its anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing framework. That is according to Mr. Brian. Now, of course, this is definitely a good move for Namibia. But for you, being an economist, Doc, I would want to ask you, what do you think has been the measurable economic impact of Namibia's grade listing since February 2024?
Well, I don't have much information on that, Happy, but what could happen if you are grade listed is that investors are a little bit worried to come and invest in your country because they are afraid that FATF could penalize them for investing in a country that is not having strong AML, that is anti-money laundering, terrorist financing, and all those kind of stuff that leads you to being grey listed. So I don't think it has affected us to a great extent in terms of inflow of foreign direct investment and investment in general. So, but that is good news. It looks as if everything goes well, by April this year, when they come now for the final review, we could get off the grey list. Now, when we are trying to woo or attract investment in the petroleum or oil and petroleum industry and other investments, it'll be very, very important that we are off that list so that investors can feel very safe to come and put their money in here. So I think that is, it makes economic sense in terms of attracting investment.
Mm, interesting. So investment definitely would, could be, been have been affected because of the grade listing, right? It's a question that I also had in my mind to think that it probably obviously did have an impact on those who want to invest within Namibia, but then because of the grade listing, maybe discouraged to do so.
Yes, yes, sometimes they will. Because now with the Americans being on everyone's, that is the Trump administration, trying to penalize people left and right and the like, it will be very good to be off that list. South Africa just get off the grey list, so which is also a very good thing because they are one of our big trading partners. So if Namibia also goes off that, that will be a very good good news too.
Mm-hmm. Now, from an economic standpoint, how do the cost of implementing certain reforms that have been implemented now compare to the costs of remaining grey listed?
Yeah, you are very right. Some of the things that the FATF was pointing out is the weakness at FIC, the Financial Intelligence Center, and that related to staffing. The same thing that the parliament always cry about, it is also the staffing or the budget that is to the ACC, the Anti-Corruption Commission. So the two institutions had weaknesses, and you are very right in saying that if you have to comply and have staffing to the levels that are required, then definitely there will be some cost. But overall, I think that would be a good thing for the country, because if you look, for instance, at the Anti-Corruption Commission that is investing cases, and the link that they want to establish between FIC, that is the Financial Intelligence Center, to also be on cases of people who had been, let's say, caught for corruption, then what you are saying is that we will trace that money. If Namibian money, for instance, is now taken out of the country illegally, then we'll be able to trace that and bring that money back. Let's say it is NAMCOR or FISH, or FISHCOR or whatever, that money will come back, as well as, So the cost is justified. And also, as we have said, if money can move freely to Namibia without fear, that is investment. That is foreign direct investment. That will be a very good thing. And also the whole thing of beneficial ownership, where we are going to try and see who are the beneficiaries of some of those companies that are operating here. Those, some of those companies could belong to some unscrupulous politicians as well, locally and abroad. So basically, I think the benefit outweighs costs. So I think to a certain extent, there is, it's not a very bad investment.
Indeed. Now, Dr. Omu, does exiting the grey listing create an opportunity to accelerate broader structural economic reforms? And also at the same time, how can Namibia now leverage this moment or this opportunity to improve its investment climate?
Yes, I think Namibia's investment climate is not very bad. You see, investment chase money and profits. When they smell profits, sometimes they don't need an enabling investment climate, as we have seen in the DRC and other countries where there's war and other things, but they go there. So, but overall, our investment climate, our investment that what they call enabling investment environment is quite good. The whole thing is that perhaps one of the things that they could also accelerate is the investment bill, so that we can have an investment act. You remember it was tabled and then it was withdrawn, and then so some of the economists as well as commentators see that as something that could lead to uncertainty, because you don't exactly know what will happen when you bring your money into Namibia, or even a local investor when you put your money in some ventures. So it is very important that what we now need is that investment bill to be approved so that it can be enacted.
Now, from an economic perspective, Dr. Omu, what economic indicators should we perhaps monitor or look ahead of the June 2026 financial AFTF decision?
A very big question, but what we should monitor is how many jobs had been created. We cannot look at indicators like economic growth, for instance. You can have economic growth without employment. meaning that you'll still be stuck in the same kind of cycle of poverty and very low incomes and suffering of your populace. But if we can show, even in this first year of the seventh administration, if I may call it that way, because sometimes it is called the eighth administration, that is the first year of President Netumbo's administration, we should now show how many jobs had been added. Otherwise, all those other indicators like interest rates, inflation rate, economic growth, etc., are just meaningless indicators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. What should Namibia continue to do, or maybe not continue? What should Namibia now consider doing and on a continuous basis that will now prevent us going into the grey listing area?
Come again, Eddie.
What can Namibia do from now henceforth? What can we be doing to prevent us getting into the grey listing?
Definitely, there is a checklist. They know exactly what has gotten us on the grey list. So I think SEEK, and there is much political will to support the SEEK, that is the Financial Intelligence Center. I think to a certain extent also the Anti-Corruption Commission. So we should continue doing the right things. They know exactly what you should do not to get on that list. And henceforth, listening to Brian Asep, for instance, I think Namibia is ready prepared to work very hard, not only to get off the list, but once we are off that list, to stay off that list.
Indeed, to stay off that list. Dr. Omu, your last words perhaps as we conclude this interesting discussion regarding Namibia and grey listing.
Yes. I think we should congratulate SEEK and Mr. Brian Asep for working so hard, as well as our government, working so hard to get us off this list. Because if we are off and there are investments out there that wants to come to Namibia that could create jobs, that will be a very good thing, because with these high and unsustainable employment figures or unemployment, it could lead to instability, where we are always, as Namibians, proud ourselves as a stable and peaceful country. It could just overnight change if we don't change the unemployment situation.
Indeed. Dr. Omu, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Radio News Analysis.
Thank you, Happy, for having me, and thank you to your listeners.
Okay. Indeed. Now, should you be interested in asking questions or perhaps sharing your contributions on Namibia's not yet exit, but soon to exit the Financial Action Task Force grey list after successfully addressing all 13 strategic deficiencies identified in its money laundering, anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing framework? Well, the studio number is open, 083-288-401. Should you have questions, opinions, or contributions, please come through and let's tackle them together right here on the Radar News Analysis. For now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace.
Why pay more when you can pay less at USave stores? Enjoy nutritious and delicious meals for the whole family. 2 kilogram real good frozen mixed chicken portions for only 99.99 Namibian dollars. 3 kilos Polana pasta, just 74.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams of Romy 37% fat spread, just 14.99 Namibian dollars. 700 milliliter crystal gold tomato sauce, just 24.99 Namibian dollars. USave, where good food costs less.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually
to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So, not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Lipura nengeno wapubwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano hile koshuala onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okupitira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nuneudo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamoili nawa Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko mderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. Now the honorable Minister Lucia Ipumbu, Minister of Home Affairs, Immigration, Safety and Security, is addressing staff members in the Omsati region as part of the ministry's ongoing nationwide engagement and oversight program. Now, the visit forms part of the ministry's broader efforts to strengthen service delivery, assess operational challenges and reinforce institutional accountability across regional offices. And it comes at a time when government departments are under increased public scrutiny to improve efficiency, reduce service backlogs, enhance responsiveness to community needs. But with this, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nenge no wapubwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tite opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano hile koshuala. Onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nuneudo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamoili nawa. Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile ko mderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. And now for News Beyond the Borders. But before we do get to News Beyond the Borders, we tackle economic indicators right here on the Radar News Analysis. And of course, I'm certain if you've been a faithful follower of On the Radar News Analysis, we did discuss thoroughly about the US dollar compared to the Namibian dollar. And the Namibian dollar is picking up strength against the US dollar. And indeed today, one US dollar is equal to 15.99 Namibian dollars, 15 Namibian dollars, 0.99 cents. And one Swiss franc is equal to 20 Namibian dollars and 77 cents, while one Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars, 11 Namibian dollars and 22 cents. One euro is equal to 18 Namibian dollars and 94.94 cents. One United Arab Emirates dirham is equal to 4 Namibian dollars, 0.35 cents. One Botswana pula is equal to 1 Namibian dollar, 0.21 cents. And one Botswana pula being 1 Namibian dollar and 21 cents also gives a good indicator that one Botswana pula or Botswana pula is also quite a strong currency compared to other currencies. And one Kenyan shilling is equal to 0.12 Namibian dollars. And now let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back very quickly and tackle with News Beyond the Borders of Namibia. All right, let's get right into it. Now, of course, we always start off with news, with regional news, and then move over to continental news. Thereafter, you can expect international news right here on the Radar. So you can also understand what's happening right there outside the borders of Namibia. That is what news, why news is so important, information dissemination, so that we are also well aware, and especially for those who sometimes tend to travel or desire to travel, then they are well equipped. Now let's focus on South Africa's water crisis.
Facing a severe, multifaceted water crisis, which is driven in the main by aging infrastructure, climate-induced droughts, and rapid urban growth, all of which are threatening to collapse the system around the country. Let's get a better sense of the nature of the issue, bringing the CEO of the Musina Makado Special Economic Zone in Gundo Maswime, who joins us now via our video link. Gundo, it's great to chat to you again. Thanks very much indeed for making time to speak to us about this complex issue. There have been briefing after briefing from officials at a local government, provincial and national level. And I wonder from where you're sitting, whether you get the sense that the problem has been clearly and accurately articulated so far.
Yes, thank you. The issue is known and is understood. And if you read government documents on the National Maintenance Strategy and all of there's a number of documents where you can see that the government actually understands what the problem is. It's just most of the initiatives that they started, they were stopped before they could even show any results. An example is the war on leaks. For example, there was another initiative by DBSA to trace infrastructure, water infrastructure across the country, and try to generate digital maps, because we don't have those maps. So while the problem is known, what is not known is the extent of the problem, because we don't really know where the infrastructure is.
Sure, which is quite the thing. You speak about essentially projects being abandoned along the way. At that point, is there kind of any explanation about why that happened? I mean, is it a lack of good governance? Is it corruption? Is it a genuine not knowing what the potential dangers were going to be?
The pattern that I think government is now trying to address is the situation where there is a change in the leadership, and that change also triggers a change in priorities. And some of the priorities that we walk away from are important priorities. So the issue of war and leaks, for example, how the program ended before the leaks were identified It's not very clear, but it would have helped the city of Johannesburg, and Randwater was also fully behind it. And it was a good program, except maybe that the people who were trained, because of the short time, they would not have been at the level where they would do what professional plumbers could do. But that the change of programs, is because of the change of administration sometimes.
Sure. You speak about this war of leaks. I mean, for people who don't have an intimate knowledge of what the issue is like, it might seem like a pretty easy thing to solve. I mean, just find where the leaks are and close them. Is it that simple?
No, it's not simple at all, because one, water pipes do not have manholes, so it's not easy to know where they are. So it's very, very difficult to trace the pipes. So they would walk around without knowing where the leaks will be found. They are just looking on the surface. So if there's a digital map of the pipeline, you would then walk right where the pipelines are while you look for leaks. So that was the first thing. Yeah. The second thing is that we don't know where the valves are, and to fix a leak, you must close the valve first. You won't fix a leak while the pipe is while the water is coming out of the pipe. So because we don't know where our infrastructure is, we don't know where the valves are located. That was the other issue.
This is very concerning, Kundoyin. You say it with such a calm tone. So we don't know where the pipes really are. We're not sure where the valves are. We know we are losing, I think it's almost 50% of the water that is in fact purified to leaks. And from where I'm sitting, it's very difficult to kind of find the solution. So what happens next? I mean, do we just wait for the crisis to get worse?
No, I think from the state of the national address, there's an acknowledgement that the solution will not come from local government. Because if you look at the problem, you will realize that the bulk water supply from the Department of Water Affairs, Water and Sanitation, is not so much a challenge. In fact, there are dams that are built, like Nandoni Dam in Bembe District, where the reticulation is what needs to happen next. So most of the challenges of water infrastructure, they are in local government, and more than half of municipalities do not have the capacity to fix them. There's more than 120 out of the 257 municipalities that do not have an engineer in their employ. So, and others have one engineer. So what we need to do is to look at a centralized solution or a regionalized solution from the water schemes, and look at what type of programs can we start at that level, and then recruit engineers to do the work to assist the municipalities.
From where I'm sitting, that seems that might take some time. Are there any quick fixes, short-term solutions, as people try to make do with the lack of water currently?
In all honesty, there are no quick fixes. And the longer we delay starting a program to generate a digital footprint of where all our infrastructure is, not just water, because most of them were lost in 1999 when local government started. So we have to start this program. It might take us 7 years. It might even take up to 10 years. But it will be easier in rural municipalities where the water infrastructure network is not that fast. And I think what is happening in the city of Johannesburg is really just a warning of what would actually happen when you do not know where your infrastructure is running.
Sure. Sobering indeed. The best time to start was a decade ago. Perhaps the second best time to start is now. So hopefully we'll get around to it rather sooner than later. Kundo Maswime, great speaking to you, sir. Thanks very much indeed for your time.
Africa must unite and speak with one voice. That's the word of South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa. Let's take a listen.
U.S. President Donald Trump's pick for ambassador to South Africa, the conservative activist and writer Leo Brent Bozell III has arrived in the country, and he will seek to improve some of the fraught ties between the United States and South Africa. Now, he's expected to present his credentials to President Cyril Ramaphosa before officially taking up his post. But for more, let's speak now to SABC News specialist correspondent Sophie Mukwena. Sophie, good morning. So we have been expecting Mr. Bozell to come to South Africa. Many in South Africa have questioned his background and called on the president not to accept his credentials. What do you make of his arrival and what has transpired so far?
The president will not reject his credentials. He will accept his credentials. We don't know when. As you know, that the president will do that not only for the United States of America, but for other countries whose ambassadors' term of office has expired, and they are ambassador designate, and therefore he will accept the credentials. But the message was sent when South Africa expelled the Israeli diplomat that South Africa will not tolerate any diplomat who would violate the Vienna Convention, on diplomatic relations that was adopted in 1961. And therefore, that was a message also to the incoming ambassador or the ambassador designate, as many people have raised concerns around his previous statements and utterances. America did the same by expelling Rasool, and therefore, credentials will be accepted. We don't know when.
And Sophie, Bozell's arrival comes at a time when many have raised concerns over what U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio had to say, and they've criticized his address at the security summit in Munich. Any reaction or statement from the African leaders as you yourself were at the AU summit last weekend?
The president did respond to that when he was talking to the media at doorstop just before he left Addis. He indicated that Africa must be united, speak in one voice at this time where you have global challenges politically and as it relates to security. And he also specifically responded to the question on Marco Rubio, trying to project the previous posture of Europe of conquer and imperialism as the best policy Europe and America had, by saying that gone are those days. Let's take a listen at what the president said about this posture by the U.S. of conquer, dominance, and imperialism.
Well, Africa in the end needs to act as one. Africa needs to respond with one voice. The global architecture has changed. And some would even say the rules-based architecture of the world has, in a way, collapsed. And it therefore calls on regional bodies such as the AU to consolidate clear positions on how we as Africans make interventions in this changed world. When it comes, for instance, to issues such as trade, to issues such as how our natural endowments, which is minerals and critical minerals and rare earths, that are so needed by your more developed economies, should be dealt with. Because what we should be avoiding is a new form of colonialism, where those economies will now begin to target the minerals that they have. It is now time for Africa to do business on its own terms and to make sure that the decisions that we engendered at the G20 on how we treat our endowments, particularly critical minerals, should be dealt with. It should no longer be a case where rock, soil, and dust is exported out of Africa without being beneficiated. Now, we have leverage, and as Africa, we must use that leverage. And without enforcing ourselves or imposing ourselves, we need to be saying, we need to act as one, collectively, and deal with the wealth that we have to the advantage of Africans. Hitherto, it has not been totally to our advantage. Other countries outside the African locale have gained great advantage. Now, the geopolitical situation, having changed as it is, requires us to be smarter and wiser and use the leverage that we have without being arrogant, without seeking to impose ourselves. And this is the time when, as Africans, we must act together.
Well, that's where we'll leave it with Sophie Mokoena. And, of course, that was President Cyril Ramaphosa in response to utterances by Marco Rubio, the U.S. State Secretary of State in Munich last week.
The government of Zambia strengthens disaster response amid floods.
Following recent flooding that affected communities in parts of the country, relief efforts are gaining momentum through strong partnerships between government and the private sector. Vice President Mutare Nalumango has commended Zisk Life Insurance and Sidco Zambia Limited for supporting communities affected by the floods. Mrs. Nalumango was speaking during the handover of 1,000 bags of mealy meal from Zisk Life and 10 metric tons of ultra early maturing maize seed, together with 1,000 bags of mealy meal from Sidco Zambia Limited.
These contributions are timely, practical, and deeply appreciated.
She further praised the companies for demonstrating strong corporate social responsibility.
I'm calling on the entrepreneurs' minds, the business people, to see an opportunity in this calamity of floods. It would not just mitigate floods because it would trap the water. You are ready for it, but it will also mitigate the drought because you'll be able to irrigate. We are calling upon the private sector to get involved in whichever way you can. You can even invest in climate-related issues.
Meanwhile, Zisk Life Chief Executive Officer Collins Hamusonde said the company remains committed to supporting government programs.
We know that there are other areas of key interest that you have, Your Honor, like the school feeding program, and we will endeavor that as we go on, we see how we can support you in those areas as well, because this is what we are there for.
Sidco Zambia Limited also reaffirmed its commitment to supporting food security by providing quality seed to aid recovery among affected farming communities.
We are more than ready to partner with the government. Those are our farmers. And full pity for them. They worked so hard to cultivate. Some bought their own seed, bought their own fertilizers, and of course calamity befell them. So we feel really you call on us. It's a privilege. Really, we feel happy that you did ask us to contribute.
The donations highlight growing public-private collaboration aimed at strengthening disaster response and protecting vulnerable citizens. Daisy Mulenga, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
Meanwhile, the Examinations Council of Zambia has nullified G9 results for 1,237 candidates. Let's take a listen why.
Investigations into the alleged exam malpractice by grade 9 pupils at an empty school in Lusaka's Kabanana compound have been concluded. ECZ Public Relations Manager Nicholas Nkua says over 1,000 candidates have been found wanting after investigations confirms the allegations.
What we did after we withheld the results, we went into investigations and we proved beyond reasonable doubt that the cases were actually of assistance in terms of malpractice. So on 30th January, which was last month, 2026, the council relevant board, relevant committee of the board, nullified the results for two subjects in particular, computer studies and physical education. So candidates who were affected in physical education were 344 and then 893 candidates in computer studies. So those are the two subjects that have had their results nullified, not withheld, but nullified.
Now, ECZ has nullified results in two subjects, namely computer science and physical education. ECZ has a word of caution to both candidates in examination classes and invigilators.
The remaining subjects of the candidates have been accessed now. And I think 2 weeks ago, we were able to make available these results. We know the dangers that malpractice has on the development of this nation, and we can't overemphasize that. So we want to just encourage everyone to remain focused on studying, remain focused on supporting learners in an adequate way without aiding them in any case. I think we must adhere to professionalism as teachers.
Meanwhile, registration for the 2026 examinations for both internal candidates and General Certificate Education, GCE, will come to a close on Monday, March 6th. ECZ says the registration exercise covers grade 7, 12, and GCE candidates. Martha Kanin is at NBC News, Lusaka.
Meanwhile, Kenyan content creators explore and showcase China.
When I was there, I was able to experience a lot of things. When you talk about tourism sector, I visited the mountains there. I was at the Avatar Mountains. They have the highest and the longest bungee jump in the world, which I never got to experience, but this year I'll experience. I need to lose some weight.
It takes 41 minutes to assemble a whole of this structure.
I had a few factory visits. I get to see where trucks are developed. I get to see where phones are manufactured. That's when I knew the world is made in China. Everything you think of, designer, phones, machinery, everything, robotics, everything is made in China. You see, when you get somewhere, you are a foreigner, and you get people that are so warm. They're able to welcome you. They don't care where you are from. They're just astonished you are here. They're surprised a bit. But the vibe, you know, people invite you for food. I got a friend in China, in Qingdao, and I don't know Chinese. He don't know English. But we took out Natumia translator, and the vibe kept flowing. Then I promised him when I go back, I'll know Chinese. And he promised when I go there, he will have known English. It could be a good link of cultural exchange between Kenya and China. And also as a digital creator, I was able to show people there is a different kind of content that you can create apart from the normal that we are used to. And there's so much you can show in a country. My first visit I went there was, I went to do a factory visit. Then I also went there for business, for my construction sites and everything. Then the third time I went there, now I went as a tourist. I'm now here to experience. I have a tour guide who's taking me around from one province to the other, showing me around just like a tourist. Then I was able to create my content.
What I captured most was what people should know about China. So most of the contents I created was to show people how advanced China is and how good China is, and all about their culture and all that. I told people and my fans that I'm going to China. They were so happy and so proud of me, and they received the content very well. Up to now, those are the most viewed contents in my social media accounts.
Meanwhile, free mobile clinics are improving the healthcare access in rural Burkina Faso.
Since last July, the Burkinabe government has deployed 15 mobile clinics to specific public health facilities. Some of the mobile clinics have also been deployed to support the armed forces, who in turn provide flexible and rapid response medical care to populations in underserved areas. Adama Bagre's wife is one of the beneficiaries. His wife has been living with ovarian fibroids for years, and the lack of medical facilities in her locality
meant she'd been unable to undergo surgery. Bagre says the arrival of the clinic now means specialized care for her.
When my wife's illness began, I looked everywhere for treatment, but without success. I really suffered before coming here. It's truly a miracle that I am here at the Armed Forces Mobile Field Hospital. In less than an hour, the operation was already over.
The clinics are equipped with specialized equipment to enable healthcare workers carry out early screening for various types of cancers, but mainly breast and cervical cancer. In Burkina Faso, cancer screening packages range from between $3 to $37, an amount that is considered unaffordable for an average person or household. But the mobile clinics offer such screenings free of charge, largely subsidized by the government.
I couldn't believe that surgery could be performed in a vehicle. It was only when the patient and doctors came out of the operating theater that I realized it was real.
One medical practitioner who has been providing emergency surgical and medical care with the Army's mobile field clinic at the Tenkodogo Regional Hospital in East Central Burkina Faso says the free medical screenings are drawing large crowds.
This is a huge relief for patients who have been waiting for months. It also provides significant support to medical teams working day and night to treat patients. Since the arrival of the Army's mobile field hospital, the number of patients we treat has increased dramatically, which has forced us to move from 3 operating rooms to 4 in a day. The speed of examinations and treatment, including X-rays, CT scans and other tests, ensures effective patient care.
The mobile clinics were handed over by Burkina Faso's military leader, Captain Ibrahim Traoré, as part of his presidential health initiative to strengthen health infrastructure and reduce inequalities in access to medical services. Since their deployment, the mobile clinics have made 468 visits across several locations in Burkina Faso and attended to nearly 2 million women, raising awareness about early cancer diagnosis. Caroline B, CGTN.
When Luo Li opened the One Long ski resort in Chongli some 20 years ago, he had more staff than visitors. But things changed after China hosted the 2022 Winter Olympics. That brought new transport infrastructure to the area, about 124 miles from Beijing, and 7 more ski resorts soon opened nearby. Once China lifted COVID-19 restrictions in early 2023, the crowd started to come. Luo says One Long is now profitable for a second straight year and should exceed 600,000 visitors this year. Zhongli's economy grew about 6.5% yearly over the past 5 years, beating the national average. Once a farming community, today it bustles with tourists. That makes it a symbol for government moves to pour money into services like tourism, health, and entertainment. Beijing is redirecting stimulus from sometimes wasteful infrastructure to services in hopes of boosting growth. That comes as soft consumer demand hobbles the economy and existing measures to boost it prove ineffective. Last year's figures show that spending on services accounts for less than a half per capita consumption in China, compared to about 70% in the US. But the new approach follows the old build it and they will come model that created megacities like Shenzhen and big industrial zones, and that brings risks. Tommy Xia is the head of Asia Macro Research at OCBC Bank.
Whether each time the supply can generate demand is always subject to debate, because in China, there's no shortage of examples. Sometimes oversupply may potentially lead to the abandoned assets. I mean, for example, the theme parks, right? You can see a lot of provinces, they build a lot of theme parks, but end up with becoming the desert or becoming the kind of the abandoned assets.
Replicating Zhongli's success hinges on raising incomes and avoiding oversupply. That is according to researcher Christopher Bedor.
You can't really get this sustained rise in household spending. It's currently at about 4% year-on-year growth now. Incomes are growing at about 5% thereabouts. You can't really increase that figure much without increasing the household income number. So we've seen a lot of talk about efforts to lift consumption and disposable incomes. And I think we'll see a lot more of it because we have the 5-year plan coming up, and it's pretty clear that they're going to include something to that effect.
In recent months, Chinese state media have touted a booming ice and snow economy. It spans ski resorts, hospitality and gear, and is projected to grow to $217 billion by 2030. Making that happen will require Chinese people to have the money to spare for an often expensive hobby.
Meanwhile, the Chinese New Year sees 285 million trips on the first day of Spring Festival.
I'm now at the Beijing Capital International Airport, and just now I saw a little girl carefully guarding a box of pastries that her mother asked her to carry. And I think this cute scene can pretty much sums up the mood here today. Hands full, suitcases full, and hearts even fuller. So today is the Chinese New Year's Eve, and this is one of the busiest moments of China's 40-day Spring Festival Travel Rush, or Chunyun. And since it began earlier this month, the airport has been operating in near full capacity. During peak days, about 200,000 passenger trips are seen through the terminals. Over the entire travel season, about 8 million passenger trips are expected here in the airport. So to keep all these running smoothly, the airport has also added some thoughtful touches. For example, for people who are heading to warmer places, they can store their heavy winter coats in the airport instead of carrying them along. And there's an 8-minute assistant promise for those who are running late. And even pets have their designated service packages here. And one detail that really stands out, the wristband for the elderly and those in need. So a staff member here can identify them quickly and provide help in a swift manner. By scanning a QR code on the wristband, people can see all the available services and directions inside the terminals. Today here at the airport, it feels less like a transit hub, but more like a gateway to celebration, because in just a few hours, many of them will be sitting at a dinner table with their families, chatting, eating, and watching the Spring Festival Gala, or maybe CGTN Super Night, and sharing stories of the past year. So here at the Beijing Capital International Airport, you can really feel that every boarding call is bringing someone one step closer to home.
Meanwhile, civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson has died at the age of 84.
Civil rights icon, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, whose towering presence and vision reshaped the Democratic Party and the country, has died at the age of 84. His family put this statement on Instagram. Our father was a servant leader not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world. We ask you to honor his memory by continuing the fight for the values he lived by. CNN's Abby Phillip has a look at Jesse Jackson's life and legacy.
Jesse Jackson's life was defined by a relentless fight for justice and equality.
I was born in Greenville, South Carolina, in rampant radical racial segregation. I had to be taught to go to the back of the bus or be arrested.
Those early experiences drove Jackson to join the civil rights movement.
The fact is, against the odds, we knew there were great odds, we were winning.
In 1965, he began working for Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
I learned so much from him, such a great source of inspiration.
King named Jackson to lead Operation Breadbasket in Chicago, an economic justice campaign for black people. However, some say King was frustrated by Jackson's brashness and ambition.
I'm sure he felt I needed more time. I was 24 years old.
Both men were in Memphis in April 1968 to support striking sanitation workers. King and other civil rights leaders were staying at the Lorraine Motel.
He said, Jesse, no, you don't even have on a shirt and tie. You don't even have on a tie. We're going to dinner. I said, Doc, it does not require a tie. Just an appetite. We laughed. I said, Doc, and the bullet hit. Everything changed at that moment. It was a defining moment in the history of our struggle.
With King gone, his movement was adrift. Years later, Jackson formed Operation Push, pressuring businesses to open up to black workers and customers and adding more focus on black responsibility, championed in the 1972 concert Wattstax.
In Watts, we have shifted from burn, baby, burn to learn, baby, learn.
And he expanded his own global reach too, helping to free U.S. Lieutenant Robert Goodman, who was held by Syria after being shot down, and later other Americans held in Cuba and Serbia.
I learned how to negotiate as an African American growing up among white people. You have to negotiate every day.
The Reverend set his sights on the White House in 1984.
Milking cows in Iowa, they're coming back to the inner cities. So I learned a lot during that period.
First thought of as a marginal candidate, Jackson finished third in the primary race with 18% of the vote. That campaign almost went off the rails when Jackson used an ethnic slur to refer to New York Jews.
There's mistakes and they hurt.
He ran again in 1988, this time doubling his vote count and finishing in second in the Democratic race.
Keep hope alive on tomorrow night.
At the time, it was the farthest any black candidate had gone in a presidential contest.
But 20 years later, when President Barack ran, we would land the groundwork for that season.
In 2017, Jackson had a new battle to fight, Parkinson's disease. But that didn't stop him.
If you hold on, if your cause is right and your grip is tight, you'll make it.
Late in life, he was still fighting. He was arrested in Washington while demonstrating for voting rights. His silent presence at the trial of Ahmaud Arbery's killers prompted defense lawyers to ask that he leave the courtroom. Jackson stayed.
I am somebody.
From the Jim Crow South, through the turbulent 60s, and into the Black Lives Matter movement, Jesse Jackson was a constant, unyielding voice for justice.
May his memory be a blessing. That was CNN's Abby Phillip reporting. She even wrote a book about Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jackson is survived by his wife, Jacqueline, their children, grandchildren, and extended family. Joining us today in the group chat, Jeff Zeleny, CNN chief national affairs correspondent, Chuck Rocha, Democratic strategist and former advisor to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaigns, and Ashley Davis, former White House official under President George W. Bush. Jeff, I want to start with you. You actually just finished reading Abby's book, A Dream Deferred. And we were talking about how Jesse Jackson served as sort of the bridge from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he was his protege, to President Obama, to present day. I mean, he kept fighting till the very end.
There's no doubt about it. And the towering legacy and figure that Jesse Jackson was is unparalleled in America's 20th century. Barack Obama would not have been elected as the first black president in America without Jesse Jackson. Not because they had a close relationship. They did not. It was stressed. It was filled with tension. Their family did. But this is why. Because Jesse Jackson, through his 1984 a bid for president, and 1988, a candidacy for president. He literally changed the Democratic Party and changed the way Democrats elect their presidents. Gone are the smoke-filled back rooms at party conventions where the candidate was decided, but Jesse Jackson opened up that process through making it a delegate fight. And Barack Obama seized upon that in 2007 and 2008 and built a grassroots campaign that was basically the modern day version at the time of what Jesse Jackson did, particularly in 1988. So he paved the way for that. But so much more. He literally was the bridge between the two. But to Barack Obama, as I think back to covering him during my time in Chicago, he moved to Chicago in part because he wanted the black American political experience. And Jesse Jackson was that in Chicago. He left Memphis after Dr. King's assassination, and Jesse Jackson was there. And he moved to Chicago to start the Rainbow Push Coalition, really building the broad-based modern Democratic Party. And as Chuck knows well, without Jesse Jackson, a very similar message to what Bernie Sanders did in his campaign in 2016 and 2020, economic justice, really building a broad-based coalition. So the through lines there are so important. Jesse Jackson's fingers, his fingerprints are on our politics right now at the moment as well.
Yeah.
And let me build up what Jeff said, because it's really, really important, because Democrats need to remind themselves today, as we live in the Trump presidency, about what Jesse Jackson did. He went out as a black man and talked to poor white farmers. He went out and talked to union members about keeping jobs in America. He started building a coalition, to Jeff's point, before Barack Obama, about bringing together black, brown, and poor white people to say, look, it's not left versus right, it's up versus down. And he was the one who really started that in a day when, in the back rooms, the smoke-filled rooms that Jeff talked about, was where the power lays. And some would say, I would even might say, that some of that power has reemerged when we should get back to what Jesse Jackson used to talk about, which is the workers and the workers' party.
Because in an interesting way, President Trump has kind of gotten a lot of that coalition, especially in this past election, from increasing his black voters, but also the poor white people that just feel like the government does not help them anymore and they've lost their way. But I have a question. So I haven't read her book yet. I know you both have. But what was the complicated relationship about with Obama?
I was going to follow up with that too. No, it's a great question because I think people will wonder that.
Yeah. Look, one of the pieces of the complicated relationship was that when Barack Obama was running for president, Reverend Jackson thought that Senator Obama didn't pay him the respect that he wanted at the time necessarily. And Jesse Jackson was not a part of the Obama campaign. His son was, Jesse Jackson, a junior, the member of Congress. He was a national co-chair. But there was always a tension between Senator Obama and Reverend Jackson at the time, largely because Jesse Jackson wanted to be a bigger part of the campaign. The Obama campaign obviously did not want to go anywhere near him for political reasons and other reasons. But as Abby writes about in her book, they did reconcile in recent months and years and have a conversation, but largely because...
And with that, we have officially come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. So stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengi program, brought to you now by Loise Shimi.